supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The nor'easter is continuing to wreak havoc for motorists and commuters. Good evening. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's get a current look at travel conditions with Tom McDonald, now on location in Ocean City, New Jersey. Tom, how's it going?
Well, it's okay down here for now, but we're expecting some flooding to come overnight once high tide hits all along the Jersey coast from this nor'easter. The bigger problems are in your area immediately. Schuylkill Expressway is slow. You pick a road, it's slow. The regional rail lines, the majority of them are shut down. West Trenton, Trenton, Chestnut Hill East, Chestnut Hill West, Warminster, Glenside, Lansdale, Doylestown, Paoli, Thorndale, Wilmington, Newark, the airport, and Kenwood lines have been shut down. When it comes to driving, not much better. Trees are down all over the place blocking roads. You just can't get to there from here. And if you're trying to fly out of town, American Airlines has suspended service for the night. They are saying people can go online and rebook their tickets with no fees. But for now, it's going to be a late night for people getting home, and it's not going to get better until the morning. Once the morning comes, we're expecting to see a lot less of this aggravating snow, rain, sleet, you pick it. We've had them all, and it's going to be a better weekend as it goes into the weekend. But then down here at the shore, we're expecting some flooding. That's going to cause problems for the areas along the coastline. Also, beach erosion, especially in places like here in Ocean City where they just redid the beach. They don't want to see an inch of beach go away, Dave.
Tom, stay safe. Thanks for joining
you,
us. In other news this evening, in 2014, then-Delaware Governor Jack Markell gave notice to 6 low-performing, high-poverty schools, telling them to improve or risk closure. The so-called priority schools received up to $1 million each, and 5 of them, all in Wilmington, continue to struggle. But a rural school in the southernmost part of the state has made dramatic strides. WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
Laurel is a rough little town. The municipality of 4,000 is surrounded by watermelon farms and chicken houses. There's no other industry in town to speak of, and the nondescript Main Street is mostly deserted at noontime on weekdays. More than half of Laurel School District's students live in poverty. At Laurel Middle School in 2015, barely 1 in 7 students was proficient in math on state standardized tests. In English, fewer than 3 in 10 were up to par. But once the school was targeted for possible closure, 2 new administrators, District Superintendent Sean Larimore and Principal Rick Evans, devised a new plan for success. The results speak for themselves. By 2017, math proficiency nearly tripled to 38%. In English, scores went up nearly 20 percentage points. Susan Vanderslice and her 2 children stuck with Laurel, even when other families were looking for schools outside the district.
There were some down parts within the district then, and a lot of people would even ask why we continued to keep our child. Both of our children here, and we never wavered. We always had faith that the district would improve. It's shining now, it's superior.
So how did this low-performing school in this distressed agricultural community rebound? Many trace the origins as far back as 2010, when Laurel sought voter approval for a tax increase to build a new middle school and 2 others. The first attempt failed by nearly 200 votes. The district tried again and won by just 14 votes. A victory that Larimore relishes today.
The referendum was almost like a civil war here.
The new middle school and high school, which share a sprawling building, opened in 2015. Principal Evans said the key has been an intense focus on academic rigor in the classrooms.
One of the big things that we've focused on is just what does our instruction look like on a daily basis here? Is it rigorous? Is it does it have the big 3 that we're looking for, which is higher order thinking, use of graphic organizers, and then student collaboration? Are they talking to each other? Are they organized in what they're doing? And is it rigorous?
Okay. How many people totally got 540 over 100? Nice job today. All right.
Anybody Evans decided to focus on teaching students to meet the standard expected in the state's smarter balance tests.
We don't teach to the test. We teach the standards. And the test is based on standards. But what we do try to do is to provide on a daily basis the rigor that they're going to see on that test. You know, I'm a firm believer that You know, the old sports analogy, you know, the practice should be harder than the game.
Seventh grader Mirta Angel Gabriel was nervous at first, but adapted quickly.
We got the hang of it. We had to, like, adjust to ourselves. Like, we need to start thinking out of the box. Like, we can't be thinking, like, the simple things. We had to go higher than that.
Evans also decided to invest more resources into the heartbeat of every school, the teachers.
They're the constant in the room from year to year, day to day. So we wanted to put money into making them the best teachers that they could be.
Teachers hold professional development meetings every morning before class. Educators from the University of Delaware visit periodically to work with teachers on curriculum and strategies.
All right, here's what I want you to do. Working with your partner, I want you to do one and two together.
English teacher Amy Handy says the experts have inspired her to be better.
They come in and they work with the math and language arts departments, and basically they're taking a look at our curriculum, our lesson plans, and then they're adding any new innovation to it. It has allowed me to grow tremendously just by having this time, this collaboration.
Laurel's approach could be a model for other struggling schools to emulate, says Allison Travers, a project manager for UD's Academy for School Leadership.
Everyone understands what their focus is educationally, academically, and behaviorally, and everyone's working hard to make that mission happen.
Principal Evans predicts his school's performance will be even better in this year's round of testing. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania President Donald Trump's Interior Secretary was in Pennsylvania recently to talk about old coal mines. Ryan Zinke oversees the federal agency in charge of cleaning up thousands of abandoned mines. And for State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that Pennsylvania's problem is the biggest in the nation.
Black Dog Hollow is a 100-foot-tall pile of coal and rock, an ugly hill created by the unwanted cuttings from a mine that closed 30 years ago. Nothing grows on it. It's eroding into nearby streams, and acid runoff pours off of it every time it rains. At a crowded fire hall just down a hill from the pile, Marianne Kabaki said it's generally a nuisance.
We have ATVs riding there, a lot of trespassing. Of course, it's unsecured, many entrances and exits to the dump. So we've had a lot of complaints about that, and we have had people get hurt there.
Kabaki is the secretary of East Bethlehem Township in Washington County. She was awaiting the arrival of Ryan Zinke, Secretary of the Interior. Zinke had chosen her town as the place to announce this year's abandoned mine funding because East Bethlehem is a poster child for why the program exists. Created in 1977, the Abandoned Minelands Fund helps states deal with the legacy of historic coal mining. With funding from the program, Black Dog Hollow is slated to get cleaned up in the next few years, which will come as a relief to Kabaki and the rest of the community.
We have, of course, the eroding channels, the water that fills our storm drains eventually ends up in our river. We have people that live in close proximity to the dump. One house, I believe, is within 100 feet, the closest one. People have had to suffer with this for many years, so we're glad to see something happening with it.
After arriving at the fire hall, Zinke came to the microphone. A tall Montanan and former Navy SEAL, Zinke said Pennsylvania was still ripe for coal mining.
And here there's economic opportunity, and we can do it right. But we also have to learn from the past.
That was a past before modern regulations prevented companies from leaving scars on the land like Black Dog Hollow. With federal abandoned mine funding, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection will grade the site and treat the acidic topsoil so that plants will grow on it.
I think in probably between 12 months and 18 months, we're going to see grass in the hill. And in 5 years, we'll see trees. And compared to what it is today, to what it will be, that's in a positive direction.
Zinke revealed the amount for this year's cleanup program, $300 million, and he even signed one of those symbolic oversized checks.
It's only as good as the government.
Of that $300 million, Pennsylvania's share will be $55 million, second only to Wyoming. It's an increase over what the state has gotten over the past few years, thanks to a change in funding set out by Congress in 2006, when it reauthorized the program. The state's share is so big because it has so many old mine sites, 800, the most in the country. John Stefanko of the Pennsylvania DEP said that all told, the state's abandoned mines would cost $15 billion to clean up. At current funding levels, that work will go on for decades.
It's really hard to how to predict, but it definitely will not be in my lifetime and probably not your lifetime either.
The DEP has yet to determine when it will begin construction on Black Dog Hollow. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
In the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida school shooting massacre, retailers including Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods are enacting new sales restrictions. And lawmakers are at the least paying lip service to considering new regulations intended to reduce gun-related violence. Let's revisit the matter with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, among those lawmakers, Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey, who is again reaching across the aisle, partnering with West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. Now, much of what they're looking at pertains apparently to background checks.
That's right. Those two senators had proposed a bill, as we know, earlier, a few years ago, and it went nowhere, and now it's still up there. And when they had that meeting this week with Trump, President Trump met with senators, extraordinary meeting, and members of Congress that we got to see televised live. He, in essence, said he supported the idea of background checks, which would be great with the American public if he does, and if Congress follows through and they pass this type of law that Senator Toomey is advocating. Because that's at the top of the chart of everything we ask about and have asked about gun control. Background checks is at the top. 90%, 94%, 97%. These are extraordinary numbers, Dave, when we measure public opinion. Those are the percentages that favor background checks, however it's phrased, universal background checks before any gun can be sold and so on and so forth. So that would seemingly, from the public's perspective, be a no-brainer. In fact, right now, and I've been reviewing the data since the shootings in Florida, Americans favor a lot of things that could be done to restrict access to guns and, in turn, hopefully restrict these kind of horrific shootings that we've seen.
For example, age limits?
Yes, I've seen data on age limits. Americans favor saying that 18 to 21-year-olds cannot buy guns, which is what, as you mentioned, we've seen from Dick's Sporting Goods and from Walmart. Now we have, when pollsters ask about AR-15s directly or when they ask about assault weapons, we're clearly seeing in majority territory support for those things as well. And, of course, there's always support for things like better checks on people who seem to be threats or have mental illness and so forth and so on. The only thing that Americans don't favor is outright bans on guns. One pollster I saw asked about that, and, of course, relatively few Americans, way down, I think, below 20% favor that. But a lot of these other things right now, at any rate, Americans are saying yes to.
Frank, prior to Parkland, Florida, were guns a big concern when you polled Americans about the problems in the nation?
They were not. At least they were not top of mind. We talk about it often that every month we ask Americans what's the most important problem facing the country, and we just don't see guns or even mass shootings coming up to the top. What does percolate to the top are problems with government dysfunction itself. We did see immigration pop up because it was moved up by Republicans last month and so on. But even after past mass shootings, we haven't seen guns jump up to where it's number one. We're in the field now as we speak this weekend, Dave, so by next week we'll know in our March update whether or not guns has risen near the top of the list when we ask Americans what's the biggest problem facing the nation.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. This weekend, the annual Philadelphia Flower Show opens at the Pennsylvania Convention Center with this year's theme, Wonders of Water. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the show highlights water in backyards and in the wider watershed of southeast Pennsylvania.
The Philadelphia Flower Show always had fanciful water elements as part of its garden displays, but by adopting water as this year's theme, exhibitors went large with 30-foot waterfalls, reflection pools, and a replica mountain stream of ice melt. One exhibit encourages visitors to think about local water, the Delaware River watershed, That network of rivers and tributaries flowing from the Poconos Mountains through the farm fields of Bucks County, filtering through the concrete urban core of Philadelphia, and out to the Atlantic through the low marshes of New Jersey.
So one of the things that we tried to illuminate was that nature is designed to help itself and to protect itself.
Victoria Prizia designed this exhibition called Windows on the Watershed.
We came up with this idea of protectorscapes, which plants and trees work together in each one of these land use areas, and which ones could we highlight as superheroes.
With gardens representing four different local ecosystems, Prizia wants to show how people are taking cues from nature for insights into purifying and managing a resource that supports 15 million people.
That's a significant story. And it's an important one. It's about 5% of the U.S. population. But it's also a success story, so there are things that can be used as models in other places.
The Flower Show will host a day-long symposium next Wednesday about the watershed with a roster of 17 speakers talking about how to harness nature to better manage water. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Turns out you can find your way home. Native Philadelphian Paul Green is back from New York State. He returns a decade after stepping away from the School of Rock Music Schools that he founded in 1998, and now he's spreading the spirit of rock and roll with a new iteration. Paul Green, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, we'll discuss the new Paul Green Rock Academy in, of all places, Roxborough, but first take us back to 1998 and the then Paul Green School of Rock Music.
Putting myself through college, first community college, and then Penn, which I snuck into. I was going to go to law school then with a philosophy degree from Penn. Loved teaching actually more than I ever loved playing out, and started having my kids do jam sessions on the weekend, which was such a great tool for them, which became the perfect tool once I started having those jam sessions lead the shows, because if you practice, you'll get good at guitar. If you don't, you won't. So always having a show on the calendar became the impetus. And then I just caught lightning in a bottle, like, right, you know, I could be a chapter in Outliers, you know, right place, right time. The parents loved the rock music. The kids, it was making a big comeback at the end of the 90s.
So what's evident is your love of teaching and your love of music, but you must have also had some entrepreneurial sense as well.
As a little punk rock kid from Philly, somewhere along the way I developed a work habit, you know, working in restaurants. I knew I wanted to be the boss, so I quickly saw that what I had created with School of Rock was something I could hire people for and then expand. You know, just 4 years into it, we had schools in Downingtown and Cherry Hill and in Atlantic City, Doylestown. So I really saw that there was something there. At first, I thought that it was something only I could do. But then I realized it was something I could teach others to do, which was, from an entrepreneurial standpoint, a much better program.
When you got out from under in 2009, was it your thought then that you'd ever return to it?
I knew I would teach again. I made the classic mistake. I was the chef who opened too many restaurants, and I was never cooking anymore. I just was going to ribbon cuttings, and that wasn't, you know, particularly – I have no regrets, and I'm very happy with what School of Rock is doing now, and it's still a lot of my favorite people are there. But for me, I wasn't in a room with kids teaching as much as I wanted to be.
You seek out students aged 10 to 18 who are serious about learning music. Is it with the intent of them primarily making it perhaps more than their passion, their avocation?
Excellent question. Yes. So the new school is the Paul Green Rock Academy. And it's basically, you know, with School of Rock originally, there was the main school and then the all-stars. There was 50 all-stars that would tour and play with rock stars. And so I'm basically with law school, with a family, I'm just doing the all-star portion of it. I just want kids who really want to do the work to get really good. And what they choose to do with it, you know, nobody ever got to the age of 40 and said, gee, I wish I never learned to play guitar real good, you know?
So, Paul, on the chance that there are still openings in your class and I might have some chance of entering, give me an example of what I might encounter in terms of the teacher-student relationship.
So, you know, I find that in our world, a lot of guitar players, for example, learn from tablature. And tablature is a great tool, but I always say it should be your last tool. Learning things by ear is your best way because it goes to a better part of the brain. I don't have the best ear, but I force myself to try to learn things by ear first because it forces the connections between previous knowledge to link in rather than just rote memorization. So what I really want these new students that I'm working with to learn is the foundational principles that underlie all music. You know, most classical music follows a 1-4-5 chord progression with the occasional 6 for dramatic effect. And the same chord progression is under Three Little Birds, Wild Thing, and Ina Kleina Nach music. They're all just 1-4-5 chord progressions. So one of the first lessons I give my new students is to show them how what's called the 1-5-6-4 progression is universal. And whatever your favorite song is and whatever your least favorite song is, it has nothing to do with the chord progression, because chord progressions are, there's not that many of them, and they're reasonably universal. And what really matters is performance, style, and melody. I'm going to play a bunch of songs all in the same key, thereby someone will be in the wrong key. But just to sort of demonstrate how the same 1-5-6-4 progression probably encapsulates 2 of your favorite songs and 4 songs you don't like very much at all. So.
Anger, he smiles, towering in shiny metallic purple armor.
Or Taylor Swift.
It feels like a perfect night to make fun of our exes.
Or the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner.
Or Billy Joel's worst song.
We didn't start the fire. Or na 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 na.
Or everybody's favorite drunken anthem.
Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit.
In fact, if you actually look at the 90s, I think 7 out of every 10 hits in the 90s have this chord progression. So with my kids, every song I have them learn, tell me the numbers. That's what I always want to know. Tell me the numbers. Don't tell me the chords. Tell me what the numbers are. Because what these kids have to realize is, you know, when we do a show, we'll rehearse for 3 months getting ready for it. But when they go out into the real world, they might just rehearse at soundcheck.
Well, then in that context, thanks so much for making time for us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Green, proprietor of the Paul Green Rock Academy in Roxborough. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. As noted earlier, the annual Philadelphia Flower Show opens tomorrow. And this, the parts of the show exploring watersheds, are funded by the William Penn Foundation, which is a supporter of WHYY. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.